you remember, we're in search of the answer to a mystery, a puzzle. We're on a treasure hunt. And in doing this, we're trying to put together a jigsaw puzzle of clues and attitudes. And so far, we've filled in, by the end of today, we will have filled in the first half of this jigsaw puzzle of the explanation for our modern world, how we got here, what this modern world is, or at least particularly the modern world that I know in the West, in Europe and America. And you as Chinese will have to see how this picture fits with your own understanding of China and your hopes for the future. So, in the first lecture, we looked at the question, which is, how did the modern world emerge? And if you remember, I defined modernity as the separation of politics, religion, and ideology. Economics and society, and these are separated from each other, artificially separated. Of course, we can never really separate them, but we try to do so in modern Western societies. We try to keep our religion out of our politics, our social life is separate from our economic life, and so on. This is our ideal, at least, even if we fail in practice. Where did this come from, this very strange separation? Because, of course, our lives are not separated. Everything we do is interconnected, and most societies see them as interconnected and practice a way of life which connects them. But modernity came about through these separations, and that is the question I'm trying to pursue, how this happened. In the second part of this first lecture, I looked at war, trade and empire, to see how these, particularly in relation to the British Isles and England, had led to the growth of a very powerful empire, which ruled something like a quarter of the population of the earth. In the third in the first part of the second lecture, I looked at what gave this empire force and what made it possible for Britain to dominate the world, which was the agricultural revolution and particularly the industrial revolution. I pointed out the British industrial revolution was 50 years before any other industrial revolution, and I stressed above all the effect of coal on that industrial revolution. And in the second half, I look at the origins of capitalism. I followed the lead of Max Weber, Karl Marx, in suggesting that England was the first capitalist society, which really, in essence, meant the separation of the economy from the society. And that happened in England 1,000 years ago. Though it's only just happening, in most of the world, it's only happened within the last 100 years. England, it was very old. And then in the last lecture, I looked at some effects of all this, a very productive industry and agriculture, a great empire and capitalism, on leading to a very rich country. One of the signs of modernity is that we eat well, we have good clothes, we have nice houses, we have a good material standard of living. And England has had a good material standard of living, again, for 1,000 years. And the last, as an index of this, the last famine in England occurred nearly 800 years ago, whereas the last famine in China, as you know, occurred only 40 or 50 years ago, and likewise in India, and so on. So England has been very wealthy, had good clothes, good food, good beer, and so on, and a lot of leisure. And I'll come back to the fact that it had a lot of spare capacity to enjoy itself in this lecture. The second half of the last lecture was looking briefly at universities and their role, the only surviving medieval collegiate universities in the world with continuous history are Oxford and Cambridge. And without that freedom of thought and great science emanating from those universities, the modern world would not have occurred. And likewise, the scientific revolution was a pan-European phenomenon, but it was made practical and put into effect through the Industrial Revolution in England. So, two more pieces for the jigsaw: caste and class, games and hobbies. Because each time I add a piece to the jigsaw, I hope I'm making you think, well, okay, so that's another piece, but why that? What, where, now? Because this has not explained anything. This is the fact. The greatest empire, the first industrial revolution, the first scientific revolution. Those are facts, but what caused those facts? Each time we have to take another step. And here in this lecture, I think we're coming to what I consider to be some of the most important factors, which lie in, not in the economy, but in the society. Economics doesn't explain very much. It gives you a picture, a moving picture of how the world develops in its material aspects, but it doesn't really explain why that world occurs. And you have to then move to other factors, particularly social structure. So, starting with caste and class, which I think the key, if you want one key to English Western civilization, particularly English civilization, we have to look at the class structure. What Marx would have said were the relations of production, not the forces of production, which is up there. But moving on from capitalism to the relations of production of the class system. I really understood this first when I read Alexis de Tocqueville. Have any of you heard of Alexis de Tocqueville? Yes, good. Well, to my mind, he's perhaps the greatest of all political scientists and social thinkers. That's right. I talk about technology, but I'm not very good with it. De Tocqueville, when I read his Ancien Régime, his great work, the end of his life, he was a French nobleman who had watched the revolution in France, visited America, married an English wife. And he saw something which was invisible to the English themselves, because he was an outsider. And he, in this immortal passage, he summarized what is the heart and essence of it. If I had to have one passage which describes the secret of modern society and civilization, particularly English civilization, this is it. Wherever the feudal system established itself on the continent of Europe, it ended in caste. In England alone, it returned to aristocracy. I have always been astonished that a fact which distinguishes England from all modern nations and which can alone explain the peculiarities of its laws, its spirit, and its history, has not attracted still more than it has done the attention of philosophers and statesmen. And that habit has finally made it, as it were, invisible to the English themselves. He continues, it was far less its parliament, its liberty, its publicity, its jury, which in fact rendered the England of that date so unlike the rest of Europe, than a feature still more exclusive and more powerful, England was the only country in which the system of caste had not been changed, but effectively destroyed. And it was this system which had destroyed caste, and these are my words, which passed to America when it was colonized in the early century, 17th century. And he says, with the English, it passes finally to America. Its history is that of democracy itself. For him, the class system is really democracy. Now, what did he mean by caste? Well, the caste system, the Tocqueville had written a bit about the caste system in India. A caste system is basically one where you have groups who in the famous caste system of India, you have the Brahmins, you have the Kshatriya, the rulers, the warriors, you have the ordinary merchants and tradesmen and other people like that, and you have the peasants. And then you have outcasts. In such a system, this line here is a huge wall which you cannot get over. You cannot move from here to there, or from here to there. You cannot marry from here to there. You cannot eat with these people. You cannot drink with these people. You cannot touch these people. They are a different race. It's often put in terms of the family, of the body. The Brahmins are the head, the warriors are the arms, and these people are the body and the legs that do the work. And just as your legs cannot become your head, or your stomach become your arms, so in that caste system, you cannot move between. Now, what Tocqueville is saying is that such a system, such a caste-like system, or obviously what we call a caste, is what you find all over Europe, continental Europe, before the French Revolution. It had developed into caste, whereas in England, it hadn't. It had a class system, which is based on, as Marx says, the differential ownership of the means of production. But it is not fixed. You can move, you can change your class. Your children can, through education, move upwards. In this situation, you are born a peasant and you stay a peasant. You can be as educated as you like, as rich as you like, but you will never become a Brahmin. So let's look at this class system in a little more detail in the English case. All over Europe, you had a system where you had the same Indo-European caste system. You had the nobility nobilité. I'll use the French version. Nobilité. You had the clergé, the clerics, the Brahmins, you had the bourgeois, and you had the peasants. And in the French system, and in the Italian system, and the Spanish system, and so on, the nobility are a separate legal estate. You're born a noble, and your children are noble, and you are treated in law and every other respect differently. The extraordinary, most extraordinary thing about England, and I will talk about this a little more, is that English law, common law, does not accept any legal differences between people from the beginning. As the great historian, the greatest historian of English law, a man called Maitland put it, our law hardly knows of a noble or of a gentle class, of nobleman class. All free men are in the main equal before the law. When he says in the main, the only legal privilege you had as an aristocrat, I won't use the word nobleman for England because we didn't have a nobility, we had aristocrats. The only special privilege an aristocrat had was that if he committed an offence and was to be tried, he must be tried by his equals, what we call his peers. And the peers, in this case, were other aristocrats. And that was why, in the past, if you committed an offence as an earl or duke or something like that, you would be tried by the House of Lords, who were other people of your equal ranking. Otherwise, there was no legal difference between you and an ordinary shopkeeper. So these people are richer, more powerful, but they are not different, in essence, from ordinary people. That means that there is no intrinsic bar or thing to prevent a marriage between an ordinary farmer and I'll put the English version here. So you have aristocrats, and there is no reason why an aristocrat or his daughter shouldn't marry anyone. And if an aristocrat commits an offence against an ordinary person, then they will be tried by the ordinary courts of England. So legally there is no difference. There is just a difference, as I'll point out, by of wealth. Below the aristocrats is the most important social class in England, and totally unique. And that's called the gentry, or the gentlemen. They are a bridge. Gentleman. They are a bridge between the aristocrats and the huge English middle class, which are below them. They are, in many ways, as I said, the most important distinctive and exceptional feature of English social structure. De Tocqueville realized this. He said, the word gentleman is the key to English social structure. Commenting on the word, he wrote, there is none more pregnant, that means full of meaning, nor containing within it so good an explanation of the differences between the history of England and other feudal nations in Europe. And he was puzzled by it. How was it that the word gentleman, which in our language denotes a mere, that's in French, a mere superiority of blood with you, that is with the English, is now used to express a certain social position, an amount of education independent of birth. It's nothing to do with blood. You're not a gentleman because you're born into a gentleman's family, but because you have learned to be a gentleman. You express it. It's a status group which you express through your life. And he continues, so that in the two countries, the same word, though the sound remains the same, gentilhomme and gentleman, has entirely changed its meaning. He was puzzled by this. And again, the key to this is that gentleman has no legal status. It doesn't make you any better than anyone else to be a gentleman in law. As Maitland wrote, English gentilhomme, gentix homme, has no legal privileges. Even if you were given a knighthood, if I was Sir Alan Macfarlane, then it would give me no advantages except to be able to write Sir Alan Macfarlane on the top of my headed notepaper. If I am caught speeding in the traffic, or I'm not paying my taxes, and I say, oh, but I'm Sir Alan Macfarlane, they'll say, so what? It makes no difference. You're still speeding. So As Maitland says, knighthood can hardly be accounted a legal status. The only thing about being a knight is that you have more work to do. In administrative law, Maitland says, therefore the knight is liable to some special burdens. But otherwise, in other words, you have to do more to help the community as a knight. You have to sit on in certain courts. You have to pay extra taxes, maybe. You have to attend meetings. You have new responsibilities as a knight which you wouldn't have as an ordinary person. So it's a very strange form of honour. People will honour you and say, yes, sir, etc. But you are no different except that you're expected to do more jobs. How can you tell who is a gentleman? And this is the fascinating part. The only way you could tell an English gentleman is by the way he behaves. Now, of course, I like to think of myself as an English gentleman. And you can tell that I'm an English gentleman because I'm wearing a tweed coat, reasonable shoes, walking like this, speaking like this. You can look up my CV and see I went to a good school. You can come to my house and see that I have a nice house and so on. You can hear about my job, which is that I'm a university professor at Cambridge. So from these things you can deduce that I am a gentleman. There's nothing else. That's all it is. I've got to persuade you by my voice and my background and my way of behaving that I am a gentleman. So the outward marks, the house, the clothes, the education, the accent, the self-confidence, which is very important. You've got to be able to just come to Beijing, talk to your Chinese friends with great self-confidence, and that shows you are a gentleman. So self-confidence and earning a living without having to do manual work. That is, I don't have to dig fields or look after animals and so on. I can live off a salary or investments, and that is another thing that I must do as a gentleman. In fact, my whole education in boarding schools in England was teaching me, above all, to be a gentleman. Not to lie, not to deceive, to be kind to people, to open the door for ladies, to be honourable in every way. And that was the training of a gentleman. So that at the end of all this, in the past, I would be called Sir by ordinary people, as I am now if I go into my college of King's College in Cambridge. The porters and the other college servants will say, good morning, sir, and would you like a glass of wine, sir, etc., etc. That's the only sign that I am a gentleman. And if you lost all these, if your voice lost its accent, or you became poor, or you had to start working in the fields, or anything, you were no longer a gentleman. You could just switch it off. Whereas in France, if you were a gentilhomme, a noble blood, then whatever you were doing, and however you lived, you remained a gentilhomme. So that, these are the key people. They are the ones who run England. They're the ones who go into the House of Commons. They're the ones who sit in all the legal courts. They are the ones who opposed opposed Charles I in the Civil War. The power structure in England is, if we put it in a diagram, normal power structure in somewhere like China or India is like this. Historically, I'm not talking about today, like this. So you have 90% of the population are working hard in the fields. They are peasants. They're on the soil, as Fei Xiaotong would say. So they're peasants. And then you have a very thin number of lower daimyo and mandarins in Japan and China, and then upper ones. Yeah. And you have the emperor and his court up here. In England, you have this small aristocracy and a social structure that is like this. This is the aristocracy, and this is the gentry there. And these ones run the country. They are the professionals. They are the top of the civil service, the top of the law, legal profession, the top of the doctors, the top of the academics, and they run the country. Below them is the middling sort, the middle class. This is upper middle class. This is upper class in modern, and this is the middle class. Here. Now the middle class is another unique feature of England. Firstly, because it's so big. You don't have a middle class in any other country, except America to a certain extent, which is rather from England. There is no middle class of this kind and size and nature in France, Spain, Italy, Germany, India, China, anywhere. And this is the key of England. Almost half of the English population in the 17th century were middle class or above. And the other half were ordinary people in the fields and small craftsmen and so on. There are many, many types of middle class person. They're small traders, small landowners, small manufacturers, and a lot of them are called, over much of English history, this group, the main part of this group, are called by a strange name, the yeomanry, or yeoman. Have any of you heard of the word yeoman? No, it comes up in Shakespeare and so on a little bit. So this is another key to English social structure, the yeoman. Adam Smith, in his Wealth of Nations, says that they are the key to English wealth. He says, those laws and customs so favourable to the yeomanry have perhaps contributed more to the present grandeur of England than all their boasted regulations of commerce taken together. He says, England had many geographical and other advantages, but what is of much more importance than all of them are the yeomanry of England, who are secure, independent, and as respectable as law can make them. They are the people who live in the villages, who live in the towns, who run much of day-to-day England. They sit on local committees, on church committees. They are wealthy, they are educated, they send their children to the grammar schools, they have good clothes with silver buttons, they are independent. Have any of you seen The Lord of the Rings, the film The Lord of the Rings? For those of you who have seen The Lord of the Rings, the hobbits in the Shire are really yeomanry. You know, independent, strong, salt of the earth, as we call them. People who make England. They were the people who won the Battle of Agincourt with their longbows. They're strong, they eat well, and they send their children to good schools, and their children then go to university and then join and move upwards. There's this constant moving upwards. So in one or two generations, you can move from yeoman into the gentry. And then, if you're very clever and efficient, you can move from the gentry into the aristocracy. And then below them, and I won't go into this in much detail, are the other 50%. The only thing I really want to say about them is that they're not peasants. English don't have peasants, as I mentioned in a previous lecture, they are humbler people. They will have a house, they may have rented it, they will have a reasonable amount of possessions, they'll work at smaller jobs, and they're self-respecting, some of them may be educated. They also help with local government. So you have this very large group, and they are small shopkeepers, labourers, and in the Middle Ages they had been what are called villeins. But the villeins were strange because people often think of them as, you know, unfree, almost like slaves, but they were a long, long way from slaves. English law has not recognized slavery for 1,000 years. There has been no slavery in England, within England for 1,000 years. But villeins were tied to their lords. They were like perpetual servants. They worked for a certain person. But that person had responsibilities to them as well. He couldn't hit them or wound them, and if he did so, they could take him to court. They could own property. They could pass their property on to their children. So they were like servants, permanent, bonded servants. And that is in the Middle Ages. But by the 15th century, i.e. 500 years ago, they suddenly disappeared. In a puff of smoke, no one knows why, no emancipation, because they weren't really bound. They were chained down. But they turned into labourers, some of them. Now these people also, this is what we call the lower middle class and the lower class. These people also, you could start off as a labourer or as a small craftsman, and then by hard work you could become the middle class, and then by hard work you could, and so on. So the effect of the absence of legal statuses is that you get this strange social structure. This is all happening in China now, of course. You are getting the growth of a large middle class, just as you are in India. Still only 20% or 30% of the population at the most. But this is a huge change in both China and India from a situation like this. The social classes are beginning to fill out here. So it's becoming more like this in both those countries. Much larger middle class living in cities. But this had happened much earlier. And if you look at English sources, you find that this middle class exists right back. If you look at Chaucer's work, as I mentioned, the Canterbury Tales, or if you look at other sources, you find that the middle class were there from 1,000 years ago. One historian writes about the 13th century, for example, that's 1200 to 1300. The great middle class of England is rapidly forming. A middle class not, as elsewhere, confined to a few great cities, but spread over the whole face of the land. Now, why this is such an important key is that how do you move up through the system? Well, the way you do this is by making money. As Emerson, who was an American who visited England, wrote, and he's coming from America, which was very keen on making money, but he was amazed when he came to England. He says, there is no country in which so absolute a homage is paid to wealth. In other words, worshipping, like homage, is almost worshipping wealth. It was obvious that climbing the social ladder, and I'll use this metaphor again, I hope you all know what a ladder is like, you climb up like that. Well, the way to climb up that ladder from the lower classes up like that was through wealth. Daniel Defoe wrote, wealth, howsoever got, in other words, however you made it, in England makes lords of mechanics, gentlemen of rakes. Rakes is a criminal of some kind, or at least a person who isn't a very good liver. Antiquity and birth are needless here. 'Tis impudence and money makes appear. That's the rhyming. As Adam Smith put it, every individual is continually exerting himself to find out the most advantageous employment for whatever capital he can command. It is his own advantage, indeed, and not that of the society which he has in view. The basis of capitalism is constant striving for making more money. The result is a paradox. The English social structure was and still is very hierarchical. It's very uneven. England today is the most class-based society in the world. All the time in England, we are thinking about social class, and the social classes have been preserved much more than in France or other European countries. Class matters enormously. Differences of taste, of food, drink, housing, cars, education, are what the English are obsessed about. You see it all the time on our television sets. Whenever I meet someone, I am instinctively judging them on their social classes, and they are me. A process of keeping up with other people or just exceeding them is what the English do nearly all the time. As Tocqueville says, apparent equality, no legal differences, real privileges of wealth, greater perhaps than in any other country of the world. And if you want to look at our literature, English satire, from Shakespeare to Oscar Wilde, is all about the game of class. And yet, it's a fascinating game because everyone has a chance of winning. It's an open system, in other words. It's based on merit, on achievement, on a great deal of cleverness and strategy, as well as good luck. And it's one where everything is very unsure and uncertain. And this is why we're so obsessed with it. No one really knows. So it's a system where you have many ladders. This is where you want to be, the upper class. Everyone would like to be up there with their own stately home and lots of servants and holiday homes in the Riviera and the rest of it. But in order to get up there, they have to climb up a ladder. They might decide that their children might decide to climb up the law, to be a top lawyer, or the universities, or business, or trade, or the church. If you successfully climb up and you become the Archbishop of Canterbury or the Chief Law Lords or the head of a university or the top of a great business firm or a great trading house, you will finally end up there. Most people end up here or there. But much of our life is trying to compare. I mean, is someone who is a businessman with quite a big business, say a turnover of £2 or £3 million a year, is that person higher than a university professor or higher than an ordinary judge or and so on? So you're constantly comparing these unlike things and trying to assess where people are. Because of this constant concern, it leads to perpetual unrest. The word that some people think best characterizes capitalism in the West is unrest. You're never at ease, you're never restful. Because you can, with ladders, you can climb up them, but you can easily slip down them too. Your children, who you hope will climb up, may do something wrong, and then they all fall down. So there's a constant. We have a game in England, which I don't know that you have in China, which is called Snakes and Ladders. Do you have this game in China, snakes and ladders. So you have ladders like this, and you have snakes like that. And you go along like that, and you go, and if you get on that thing, you go shooting up to there. But if you go and hit the head of a snake, you go down to the bottom of it. So our life is like snakes and ladders, climbing and then suddenly some disaster and you're down. And as a result, people are never, can never relax really until they're later in their life. And I think it's this constant anxiety about social position for yourself and your children, which is the driving energy force behind English capitalism and English success over the years. Max Weber suggested that the rise of capitalism was due to the anxiety and the insecurity created by Calvinism and Protestantism. But I think he was wrong. I think that is just a manifestation of something deeper, which is this insecurity of social status. I know myself, it's not a direct thing, I know myself that early on in my life when I was a schoolboy, about the age of 8 or 9, I went to my first boarding school. I realized that if I wanted to get on in life, it was up to me. No one was going to be able to protect me. My parents were away in another country. I myself, and that I could, if I really tried hard, I could get up as far as I could manage with my capabilities. So I threw myself into all the activities. I worked hard, I played games hard, and gradually through my life, I managed to push myself up a little bit up the ladder, and I saw other friends of mine who didn't take it as seriously and who were there, and others above me, and so on. So I was driven on by this inner feeling that I must achieve something. And even my school mottos, the first school motto at the school where I was learning to strive was a famous English preparatory school in Oxford called the Dragon School, which school motto was arduus ad solem, which is by striving, by hard work to the sun. The sun was the upper middle class, I didn't realize at the time, and by hard work I could reach that. And my second school was, the motto was, a hard nurse of men, a hard education would leave you to be strong and striving upwards. So this is really the key to a lot of that you may be puzzled about. If you read English literature, if you read Jane Austen, if you read Dickens, if you read any English or Shakespeare, a lot of it is about this. So I will then, in the second part, go on to consider how this links in with the other English obsession, which is games and sports. Thank you.